Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, some remarkable stories of Thanksgiving. First, we'll hear the story of one man's personal crisis as he faces kidney disease and a difficult decision.
After a lot of praying, I decided to go ahead with the surgery. I was not doing so well at the time, so it was a blessing, and I'm very grateful for it right now. I feel like a new man.
Plus, how the dedication and careful care of a local rescue team brought a man back from the brink of paralysis.
When a patient's neck is broken, it's very unstable, and the spinal cord is extremely vulnerable in that situation.
We'll get expert advice for dealing with an elderly driver and hear from our healing muse, all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, some remarkable stories of Thanksgiving. We'll hear how the dedication and careful care of a local rescue team and a highly trained medical team brought a man back from the brink of paralysis. But first, a son who gave his father a second chance at life with a new kidney. Well, according to the National Kidney Foundation, more than one-third of the over 90,000 people in the United States on a waiting list for a kidney transplant are African Americans. And a recent study indicated that of the 275 transplant centers in the United States, African Americans had at least a 35% lower chance of receiving a live kidney donation, with many factors contributing to this situation, including high rates of high blood pressure, obesity, and diabetes in the African American community, which would preclude them from becoming donors. Here with an inspiring personal perspective on all this is Timothy Hudson, who recently received a donor kidney from his son. And the surgeon who participated in this transplant, Dr. Vaughn Whitaker, assistant professor of surgery specializing in hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgery and transplant services at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hudson, you have recently undergone this kidney transplant. Tell us about it.
Well, it was June 3rd at a transplant. My son donated a kidney to me. At first, I was very resistant to it because I felt like he felt obligated to do so. But I was basically blindsided by the rest of my children who all ganged up on me and said, "Dad, please do this, and you're hurting his feelings." And he talked to me about some of his visits when he came in to at least check to see if he would be a match. And once he knew about certain levels, creatinine and different things of that sort, I realized that he basically did his homework. And then after a lot of praying, I decided to go ahead with the surgery. I was not doing so well at the time, so it was a blessing, and I'm very grateful for it right now. I feel like a new man, feel reborn.
So when did you discover you first had kidney disease?
A little over 4 or 5 years ago. I don't know if you remember the thing they had going around. It was called the bird flu or the swine, something from China, and it was going around, and they were telling people to watch out and there was a certain cough. Well, I got that cough, and I was sure that I had it. I'm thinking, oh no, not me. It started out as a small cough, no pain, and I remember talking to my mom and said, I'll eventually go to the doctors about this because I had this cough for the last week or so, and it's getting worse. And one night, I started coughing till I lost all breath. And I called for my sister to take me to the emergency room. And by the time she got to me, I could barely breathe.
Oh, my goodness.
I still did not know it was the kidneys because I did not associate it. I had no pain in that area, nothing, until I came in and the doctors checked me over and they said that I was in the, I don't know how he put it, but he said I was having congestive heart failure and kidney failure.
So you were in dire straits. You were in bad shape.
Yes, I was. I remember saying, okay, what do I take for this and when can I go home?
And what did he say?
He said, you're not. And they took me straight up to intensive care. I was in intensive care for several days.
Wow.
Yes.
So then what types of treatments did you have to undergo before you finally were able to find a donor and get the transplant?
Well, at the time, considering I was by standards of most people on dialysis, I was fairly healthy. My creatinine hadn't gone to quite, was on the borderline of going on dialysis.
So you were put on dialysis.
I was eventually, but not at first. They thought I'd be on dialysis in about maybe a few months, and I went maybe about a year or so without dialysis.
So how long from the time you were diagnosed with a kidney disease like this or kidney failure did you have to wait? Because you obviously, were they at that time talking to you about a kidney transplant?
They talked to me about it at that time. My daughter jumped in and she was ready to donate immediately. We had the same blood type. And she's a school teacher in South Carolina. And she stayed around for as long as she could. There were a lot of things that had to be done. And eventually, I did not want her to put off her career because she went to school for that. And some jobs are not so easy to get, or career choices. So she left to go back to South Carolina, and I figured I would wait it out, and either she'd take a summer off or I'd hopefully find a donor.
Dr. Whitaker, I mean, you've been doing this for a while, and as I said in the introduction, there's a very long wait today in general for kidney transplants, for live donor transplants, but it seems like the problem is worse in the African-American community. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, there are a number of factors, as you pointed out earlier, that contributes to this long wait for both deceased and living donor transplants. Some of them are related to the fact that African-American people as a group there's so many variety of us that, you know, the heritage is very wide, and so it's not very easy sometimes to find a good match. We're not necessarily a homogeneous population. So that may lead into that. And the other thing is that as African Americans, we are predisposed to certain medical problems. Hypertension, for example, is present in a high degree and is, in fact, the number one cause of renal failure among African Americans. And because of this, if someone has hypertension, they cannot, and is African American, they cannot be a donor. And in some other programs, if you're, for example, Caucasian and you're hypertensive on only one medicine, you may be a donor. That is not the same for African Americans.
Why is that?
Because of the high rates of progression to kidney disease.
I see.
In African Americans. The rates of obesity and diabetes. So medical problems that are sometimes there.
So it lessens the field, so to speak. The field is already somewhat diminished for live donors out there because of the matches, as you said. But in addition, these secondary medical problems also then cuts the field down in terms of
Absolutely.
Your choices.
Yeah.
But in this case, Mr. Hudson, you had a brave number of children step forward. And in the case of your son, it was a particular story that I know about that made this particularly poignant. Tell us about that. He had some trouble himself when he was very small.
When my son, the donor, my youngest son, my baby boy, he was about 6 or 7 months old. We lived in an area called Cicero, New York. I'm sure you know where that is. We were going get together with one of my neighbors, and they just recently had their lawn sprayed. Unaware of it, we put out blankets. It was a beautiful night, a beautiful day. And after the the gathering, I noticed my son was starting to become ill.
How old was your son at the time?
He maybe was 6, 7 months old. And he was a big, strong, really strong, big, healthy kid. And my ex-wife at the time had to leave town. Her grandmother passed away. And she took my daughter at the time, who was probably about six or seven, and I kept the two boys. My one was 3, and he was 7 months, so I decided to keep them with me. Right after she left, he got so sick that it was that his eyes were rolling back in his head. He wouldn't eat, and he started shriveling up, just almost to nothing. And there was a medical center out in Cicero that I took him to because of the insurances that we had. My wife, ex-wife, worked at General Motors. I was able to take him in. They weren't able to pin it down to what was going on with him, but his white blood cell count was, everything was out of whack, and we were losing him. And I remember staying up for days, no sleep. I didn't go into work. I just stayed up with them trying to get him popsicles, candy, anything. And I could call their number anytime, and they would actually open up. I remember wrapping him in a blanket and taking him to that medical center, and they would come in. I would come in. They would stabilize him, but it was getting worse. And I remember the doctor telling me that we may basically lose him, and they don't know what to do. And they said that there is one drug that they have that's not really been, I don't know what you call, qualified yet. But if I would sign the papers, and before he could say sign the papers, I had my pen out and I prayed on it because we tried everything. I signed those papers. Till this day, I don't know what it was, but they injected him and he bounced back. Wow. Thank God, because he was so shriveled up. And I remember the first time he asked for a popsicle, I cried like a baby because he would not eat. And I was just so happy, and I gave him whatever he had, melted popsicles all over the place. Now, he doesn't remember most of this.
Well, 6 months old.
Right, but I remember it. And then that same son that I had to take in to make sure that he stayed alive saved my life. And how poetic that must be. I can't believe I get goosebumps when I think about it.
And I get goosebumps hearing the story. That is quite amazing.
Yes.
That is quite amazing.
Yes.
So during the time that you were thinking about all of this, when your son came forward and said he wanted to be a donor, what did you think?
Absolutely not. No, that's my baby. The other ones, he's just, at the time he came to me, I believe he was 20. And no, you know, he's the one that I don't think you know what you're talking about. I'm your dad. Do you know what this entails? And No, you were going to take it from my sister. Well, she's older. She's educated. And I wasn't sure about hers. I don't want to force anything. You don't owe me anything. And he kept coming to me saying, Dad, I'm here for you. Let me do this. I'm telling you, I know, and I'll prove it. And he studied, and he came back with facts. And like I said earlier, I believe, once I realized he knew and did his homework, and I was really becoming ill, I don't think I would have made it much longer.
So it was really becoming dire at that time.
I was pretty bad shape.
Dr. Whitaker, there are newer today methods to try to help with this shortage. And in this case, we had a very brave family member come forward. But you and I have talked before about what's being done now to try to help in those circumstances where somebody is starting to fail and they're on a waiting list and there is no one stepping forward. Tell us about those paired exchanges.
So, you know, in the paired exchanges, you may have a donor who may not be a match for you for whatever reason. Typically, from an immunological point of view, maybe not the right blood type, or when you check your bloods together, even if it's of the same blood type, they're not compatible. And even though the donor may be willing to donate, they cannot donate to you because of this incompatibility. These paired donor exchanges, which is run through a number of different organizations, including UNOS, which is our main umbrella organization, and some other private institutions, which I won't go through right now, that run these exchanges that you can be registered in and essentially widen the net of potential donors that you can get.
So if you register as a donor, you're put in this pool.
Exactly.
And they find someone who you will match with.
Who you will match with. And then your donor who has been introduced to the pool will be then matched to someone who may be local. And in our case, we have at Upstate, we have done such a paired exchange where we matched local families a husband and a wife who were incompatible. There was an altruistic donor who came forward who was actually compatible with the wife, and then the husband who was incompatible with the wife gave to someone who was on our transplant list. Mm. So that facilitated two transplants, essentially, by someone coming
so
forward.
That type of concept is really has a lot of power in terms of shortening these lists and helping people.
And shortening the wait time. Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Timothy Hudson, who recently received a kidney transplant from his son, and Dr. Vaughn Whitaker, the surgeon who was involved in this operation. And we're talking about the challenges of waiting for and receiving a live kidney. So tell us briefly about the surgery that took place with Mr. Hudson.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say how rewarding it is to see an African-American son giving to an African-American father. It's not very often that we see young men of any race coming up to the plate to give. Usually daughters or usually it's the other way around. Mothers and fathers are always willing to give to their children.
So this is a very inspirational story.
Yes. And just like how Mr. Hudson was, I find a lot of recipients, potentially, they refuse, just like you did, refuse to accept the gift from I guess it's the parenting instinct.
It was protective. Instinct, and I can't tell you the internal guilt that I felt, wondering if I was doing the right thing. And after doing my research and inspecting the life expectancy of my son and trusting in that research, I realized that my son should live a normal, healthy life. And in fact, he's doing quite well now.
Exactly.
He runs his own business and he's active. He works out. He looks really great. He was sore in the beginning for a few weeks, but he's doing fine. And I also wanted to add something to this. And my personal experience as an African-American male, there's a lot of myths in our community, and there still are, and I'm frustrated by it, and I've actually gone back to the dialysis center to speak to some of the other patients. In many cases, the first questions that are asked are, okay, if I give up my kidney or if I get a kidney, what's going to happen to them? And that tells me immediately they have not done their research. And in our communities, the first thing I hear is, okay, if I give a kidney to someone, what's going to happen with me? And it does not work in that way. You don't just, if you leave one kidney, they go together. It's not like, oh, if you needed a kidney, you're going to need a kidney. That's the bottom line. So if you donate a kidney, it's not going to change the life expectancy. It's not going to make a difference. So if you needed a kidney, you're going to need a kidney anyway.
What else would you like people in your community to know about this whole experience?
I'm reborn. I feel healthier every day. Today is a great day. I really, truly believe I would not be sitting here talking to you today because I could feel death, and I can't explain it, but I could feel it, and I knew it. I kept quiet about it, but I would not be here. Now I'm here. I'm healthier. My son is healthy. I can plan for the future. It's beautiful not throwing up every day, being able to not have to go back on dialysis and a lot of pain. God, now it's just growing pains, and they're not so bad. And they're not so bad. It's I can see life again.
So do you also think that there's a need, or Dr. Whitaker, do you think that there's a need for more education within, well, in general in the population, but in the African-American community in particular, about some of the myths or debunking some of the myths about live donation and that kind of thing?
Yes. I mean, I see multiple recipients in my office who comes in who are African Americans who say, there is no way I'm going to take a kidney from my son or my daughter. And part of that is based on this parental love and appreciation. But a lot of it is also based on, as Mr. Hudson says, myths. They think that it's primarily unsafe. This operation is very safe. It's the same risk as driving 18 miles in a motor car.
That's pretty amazing.
Risk. Yes. I mean, me coming into work each day is driving 18 miles. Do I think about it to do it? No, I don't. The other thing is donors are so highly screened that you have to be truly very healthy in order to be a donor. And as a result of that, if you're selected, you're essentially being, it tells you that you're qualified. You're going to do much better than members of the general population.
And the fact is that the history shows that people who do donate a kidney can go on and live full lives.
Oh, they do.
They do.
They actually live. Because they're a very highly selective group. They do actually live longer and more healthier than the rest of the population.
Just in closing, what have you told your son?
Thank you, to the point where he tells me, okay, enough's enough. He'll be coming to see me tomorrow. And he lives in Buffalo, so he also came from out of town to do this for me. So he'll be here tomorrow getting his, I believe it's 3 months ago, to get in his checkup. Basically, he's just routine for him, and he's ready to get back to work.
I can't thank you enough, both of you, for this inspiring story. It's incredibly valuable for people to hear, and I want to thank you for both what you do, Dr. Whitaker, and for all of this inspiration that you've shared with us today, Mr. Hudson. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Lynn.
My guests have been Timothy Hudson, who received a living donor kidney transplant from his son, and his surgeon, Dr. Vaughn Whitaker. He's assistant professor of surgery specializing in hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgery and transplant services at Upstate Medical University. How a remarkable rescue team and a highly skilled medical team brought a man back from the brink of paralysis. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. While 1 minute Edward St. George was on the deck of his family cottage on the St. Lawrence River in Cape Vincent, taking measurements for vinyl siding work he was doing that day. The next, he was falling from the granite ledge that overlooked the deck. His neck and upper back struck the edge of the rock about 5 feet down. Mr. St. George sustained a severe spinal cord injury, which could have had devastating consequences. But he's here with us today via the telephone to share his story and how he was brought back from the brink. Also joining us here in the studio is Dr. Larry Chin, his neurosurgeon and the chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Linda.
Good morning.
So, Mr. St. George, I want to start with you. Take us back to that day. Tell us what happened.
I was finishing up construction on a small addition to the kitchen of our cottage that overlooks the river, and a portion of our deck wraps around that small addition. And as you said in your intro, I was taking some measurements to get ready to do another section of the face of that addition. And I had removed a section of railing that didn't match up with the wall construction, and I had to remove it. And I'm not 100% sure exactly what happened. I just know that when I turned my body to get ready to stand on a step ladder that was on the rocky ledge below, that all of a sudden I was going off the deck backward through the air. And as you said, I fell initially about 5 feet to the granite surface ledge that the cottage is built on, and then I went over a cliff another 15 to 20 feet down to the ground, and then did a few barrel rolls and hit the back of a cottage that's down below ours, actually, and came to rest there.
Oh my goodness. What
probably 20 minutes or so, I couldn't move anything.
So you were breathing, but you couldn't move.
That's right. I was breathing, blinking my eyes, and talking. That's all I could do. And some friends of ours who own that cottage happened to be inside and heard the thud of my impact and came to the back of the building and saw me, called 911, and took great care to not move me and didn't want me to move myself. Of course, I couldn't at that moment, but it wasn't until emergency responders arrived some number of minutes later that I could start to feel my toes. So I felt an awful lot better then, because up till that point I was pretty scared.
I can imagine. You must have been terrified. So what happened then? Who came to your rescue?
There were four or five responders from the fire department, the volunteer fire department in the town of Cape Vincent, and another group of three to four medical technicians out of a service in Clayton, New York. Our cottage is about halfway between the two towns, which are about 8 miles apart.
And what did they do with you?
Well, they initially had to figure out how to get to me, because the ground was probably steeper than a 45-degree angle, and the leaves and everything were all wet. There was a lot of underbrush and small saplings that I was laying amongst. And their first concern was to immobilize my neck. That's the first person I remember coming to me, looking over the top of my head and saying, good morning, Mr. St. George, how are you? And got a neck brace around me and a collar. And then, of course, all I could do was listen to them talking, but they were initially challenged with how to get a backboard under me and figure out how they were going to carry me out. And it took them about a good half an hour to do that. And fortunately, they managed to accomplish it successfully. They were always very careful, and someone was holding my head and shoulders the whole time so that I didn't move either of those areas of my body. And they basically slid a backboard underneath me, starting with my feet, because they tried to roll me in the traditional way, but the terrain was too steep. And then they had to be very careful when they picked me up, because they had difficulty maintaining their own footing. And fortunately, they only had to walk out about probably 30 feet to get to an area where there was a walkway and then could carry me up the steps up to the top of the hill in the waiting helicopter.
So they had a helicopter poised to do what? To take you to
airlift me to Syracuse.
To upstate.
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's closer than bringing me back to Rochester, which is, I live in a suburb of Rochester.
Now, I understand from things I've read that you might not have survived to walk again were it not for the very careful handling by your rescuers. And I want to ask Dr. Chin at this point, why is that, Dr. Chin?
Well, I think Mr. St. George really described well the challenges in treating a patient who suffered a severe spinal cord injury. When a patient's neck is broken, it's very unstable, and the spinal cord is extremely vulnerable in that situation. And any movement can either damage a spinal cord or further damage an already injured spinal cord. And that can be just from direct trauma, but it can also be from the lack of blood and oxygen to the spinal cord. And so stabilizing and maintaining a good alignment, getting the patient resuscitated are critical for really the spinal cord to recover.
So they have to make sure there's no further damage to the cord, because with the vertebrae not protecting it properly, it can be further damaged and more serious injury.
Exactly.
Permanent injury would occur.
Exactly.
And so things that they did sounds like were very crucial. At least in this initial phase.
Absolutely. I think you could argue that was perhaps the most important part of this entire journey for Mr. St. George.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurosurgeon Dr. Larry Chin and his patient, Mr. Edward St. George. We're talking about his spinal cord injury, subsequent surgery, and what you'll hear soon is his remarkable recovery. So, Mr. St. George, what happened when you arrived by helicopter to Upstate?
Well, I remember the travel down the elevator from the roof to the emergency room, and lots of lights and lots of people asking me lots of questions, and more than once the same questions. Just a flurry of activity from what I could see out of the corner of my eyes, because, again, I'm just looking straight up with my head in a brace. And I didn't understand all of the medical terminology, but they were obviously going through their traditional trauma routine to try to understand exactly the extent of my injuries. And I had lots of other cuts and abrasions elsewhere on my body, and those were being treated. And I'll never forget the attending physician in the emergency room that day. It was a woman who was heading up the team, I believe, and I overheard a quick conversation with what I think was an X-ray technician or someone that had come back with some imaging results. And, again, I didn't understand everything, but she put her hand over her heart and leaned over to me and said, "You're my miracle today, Mr. St. George." So I'll never forget that, certainly. And then I don't remember too much after that, between there and getting to some other room somewhere. Might have been a hospital room at that point, I'm not sure, or just another part of the facility in the ER. And was told I think Dr. Chin actually told me that I needed to go into traction for some period of time because one of my vertebrae had bounced out of position. I hit so hard, I guess, and it wasn't in the right column relationship with the neighboring vertebrae, and it was important to try to correct that without surgery ahead of what was going to have to be a surgical procedure to fuse my vertebrae together. So
Dr. Chin, help us understand what he was just describing and what you saw and what the plan was. And how did you arrive at all of these decisions?
Well, at Upstate, we're fortunate to have an excellent team of physicians, nurses, and staff that are very well-versed in how to treat patients like Mr. St. George. And so we were able to get the correct X-rays. And it was clear that he had suffered a spinal cord injury, but fortunately was starting to have some spontaneous recovery, which is very important, but that there was a bad misalignment of the vertebrae. They weren't lined up, and that puts continuous pressure on the spinal cord, and the spinal cord can't recover in that situation. So the first thing that we did was put him in traction, as he describes, which is basically putting a vice-like device on the skull that is attached to weights. And through gentle traction, you can get the spine to realign itself, which is what we wanted to do before taking him to surgery. And so the idea is, once the spine is in a little bit better alignment, and now we're resuscitating him, giving him medications, giving him fluids, allowing the spinal cord to recover on its own naturally. And then with that better alignment, we could then go into surgery and fix the spine so that it didn't move, and basically fuse it with the hardware.
Screws. You basically, yeah. It took a couple of days for this traction to resolve and realign the spine, and then you had to literally take him into the OR.
Right.
And what did you do for him there?
So because his spine was very unstable, we needed to stabilize it, both from the front and from the back. And that provides the stability that can then allow a patient to get out of bed and resume their recovery, which is physical therapy, rehabilitation, things like that, which you can't do if the neck is unstable. And so that's what we then accomplished.
So you basically were attempting to provide some kind of an external structural support for the spine, and that would stay in place for the rest of his life. Is
exactly.
that correct?
Yes.
It wasn't the kind of thing that was just a quick short-term kind of support, and then it could be removed. This was permanent.
Right, that's right. This is implantation of titanium hardware, plates, screws, rods, that provide a permanent scaffolding for the spine to then heal and for the bone to heal and to fuse.
And I understand there was some other complication that something occurred, you had to go back into surgery?
And that's not unusual. Mm-hmm. After we did the initial surgery, he had some continued movement in the spine, and so we went back and then we stabilized that as well. And I have to say, one of the most important things in all this is how incredibly diligent Mr. St. George was with his treatment and with his therapy. He was well informed. He knew exactly what we were doing. He participated in the therapy. And, you know, when there were issues, he let us know what they were. And I think that really allowed us to more effectively take care of him.
So it was a real partnership. Mr. St. George, help us understand what you needed to do postoperatively then. Obviously, you were in the hospital for... How long were you in the hospital overall?
Initially, I was there for 2 weeks, and then it was probably a month later that I started to feel some other things happening to my left arm that didn't feel right, and as Dr. Jen explained, I had to have a subsequent surgery to fuse one more vertebrae to the group above. And so I was in the hospital just for a couple of days for that one, because that only involved access to my cervical spine from the front, which is a lot easier to recover from. So my total time in the hospital was less than 3 weeks between the two procedures. And the rehabilitation after that was largely... After the first surgery, it was just getting my balance back and getting my walking back to the point where I was stable on my feet without an assistance device, like a walker, for example. So you gradually work up from a walker to a cane, and then you don't need anything anymore. That took about a week and a half.
And that was even before you began therapy? I mean, you were
I had therapy in the hospital about 7 days after the procedure, the first surgery.
Wow.
So there's an acute rehabilitation unit in the hospital that I qualified for and got some help before I left to come home there. And then after my second surgery, because I live in the Rochester area, I was then got connected with a Strong Memorial Hospital here and their terrific spinal cord rehab unit and their OT and PT capability, and I had a terrific therapist for about 9 months. And my biggest thing to recover from during that period was issues I had after my fall with my left arm and shoulder. I had stretched and pulled a lot of muscles and ligaments in my shoulder that caused me a lot of discomfort. And I basically could hardly lift my arm away from my body more than maybe 15 degrees without it killing me. And so... 9 months later, I have full range of motion now with my arm and my shoulder, and it can be sore on days when I'm doing perhaps too much, but I feel as good as new just about.
I think that's a remarkable story, but it also attests to so many contributors. It sounds like this was a real partnership. Clearly, go ahead.
It was, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that in the hospital, both Dr. Chin and his PA spent a lot of time describing to me exactly what had happened, exactly what the procedures were going to be, how I was doing afterwards. I learned a lot about anatomy. And so it's just been an interesting journey for me to learn all that stuff and to work hard at doing what I was told in the right sequence to get my range of motion back, including my head, side to side and up and down. And I think my therapist kidded with me the last time I was there, and she was measuring how far I could rotate my head and so forth. And she said, you can move left to right farther than I can. And she's, I don't think, even 40 years old. So. But, I'm doing very well.
It's pretty remarkable, actually, but it attests, as I said, not only to your determination and motivation, but obviously the care that you received all along the way. It strikes me you are very fortunate and also motivated at the same time. So it's been more than a year after, since your accident at this point?
Yes.
And how do you feel overall currently?
Overall, I feel very good. I have some days when I have a little discomfort in my shoulders or in my neck. If I've done a lot of driving in a particular day, my neck can be a little sore. But when I wake up in the morning, I feel almost 100% back to where I was before I had the fall. So I'm extremely grateful for the tremendous cast of characters, starting with all those folks from the emergency response unit, all the way to all the tremendous people that I met and those who took care of me, with Dr. Chin leading the team at Upstate, people in the ER, all the radiology people, the in-house therapy people that got me started, just were all so fantastic. The nurses, I had great care, and then my therapy here in Rochester has just all been sensational, and I couldn't be more thankful. So great to have my life back, and I'll never forget Dr. Chin and everybody at Upstate for their part in it, which is just tremendous.
Well, I want to just ask Dr. Chin from his perspective. He's certainly seen a lot of injuries, a lot of trauma, and done a lot of surgery. What have you? How would you comment about Mr. St. George's recovery?
Well, I think his recovery is nothing short of remarkable. I've seen some very dramatic recoveries, but I would say Mr. St. George's is probably right up there at the very top. To go from a situation where essentially you're completely paralyzed from the neck down. I think with the rapid response and paying close attention to maintaining spine alignment and then getting him very prompt traction and surgical care so that he could start his rehab, and then his great rehab afterwards. That's what got him here.
Well, I have to say, overall, this is quite a remarkable story. I can't, my jaw is kind of dropped at this point because I know that you were on the brink, perhaps, of never walking again. And the fact that you've been able to, regain your full capability regain your life in a way is very inspirational. I want to thank you so much for sharing it with us. And once again, I want to thank Dr. Chin for coming in, for all the work he does, and for coming and sharing the perspective and this very, very remarkable story. My guests have been neurosurgical patient Edward St. George and Dr. Lawrence Chin, neurosurgeon and chief of neurosurgery at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of December 1st. Secure some sleep. Did you know that regular physical activity at the right times may help you sleep better? Studies show us that people who exercise 4 days a week report improved sleep quality, longer sleep, and less time falling asleep. Well, that being said, the National Sleep Foundation recommends that you finish your workout at least 3 hours before you plan on going to bed. So, sleep soundly this week by adding exercise to your morning, afternoon, or early evening. So get some well-deserved rest and have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Sharon Brangman, Division Chief of Geriatrics and the Director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center at Upstate, shares what she tells loved ones about when and how to take the car keys away.
So this is a big issue that we deal with every day because driving is such a marker of independence, but there comes a time when it's no longer safe for someone to be behind the wheel. One of the things that can often be a telltale sign are dents in the car or other things that just can't be explained. Sometimes people will start to get a bunch of tickets and other citations. Sometimes an easy marker would be when the adult child rides with their parent or loved one and they are concerned about how the person is driving. And the biggest marker is, would you put your children, I mean the adult children, would they let their grandkids drive with that person? And if the answer is no, then we certainly are concerned. We also have to separate some of the physical issues of aging that might impair our ability to drive from the cognitive issues also. So the cognitive issues can affect someone even when they're younger. And we know that when you have a memory problem, you're at much greater risk for having an accident. But that's a little bit different from understanding the ability to mechanically drive a car versus making complex decisions and judgments behind the wheel. And that can be hard to tease out at times. But it is a very big issue, and we hear about accidents and problems all the time in the news related to older drivers. And it's something that we do have to take on, even though it is a hard decision.
So what can we do as the adult child?
Well, it's a really tough decision-making process, and a lot of times the person with memory loss doesn't have the insight or the ability to realize they can't drive, or even the older person who's frail doesn't know it either. So I would say first you have to have the hard conversation. You might enlist the help of your healthcare provider, and then it would be good to set a date when it will begin, along with a plan B. How will you fill in that gap for someone driving? And this might mean hiring someone to be available, reducing access to the car, having an adult child or a grandchild step in. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and it really has to be evaluated case by case, depending on the level of urgency.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rangman.
You're welcome.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. What brings a person to medical school, and what keeps him or her motivated through all the rigorous years of study and tests and the constant fear that one won't be good enough? Medical student and award-winning essayist Caitlin Chi suggests some answers in this excerpt from her essay, Roman Bridges. I've been thinking a lot about inheritance lately. I lost my mother 6 years ago, and for a long time I lost a true idea of who she was to me. All I could remember was the ugliness of her sickness. Even now, it's all so clear in memory, the sounds of retching, the unmistakable smells of decay, the gradual wasting of flesh. That was all I could remember at first. And also this. I remember how her toes turned chalky dry and cold to the touch. I remember trying to rub warmth into them. And before you think well of me, I remember how much I resented doing it. These are the worst of my memories. Not the sadness, not even the jarring realities that come with handling someone else's failing body. I remember how very badly I wore the badge of caretaker. The memory of my mother hoarsely whispering, too rough, as I rubbed her feet, it chastens me even now. It was the cancer that overtook my mother and made her more brittle and impatient with me. A better person would have recognized that and been more loving, more tender as a result. I was young. I was stupid. I didn't know any better. If you transplanted current me to 7 years ago, I'd be better. I would. But I'm finding time is almost always linear, and I'm stuck with this new inheritance, an understanding that I have failed to be good in the past and that I must try harder in the future. What's really left when we lose the people we love? What have we inherited? These are things we can't write into a will or lock away with a bank deposit key. These are the intangible things we begin to recognize in ourselves as not wholly ours. I think of my mother's love for spicy food and the barely noticeable freckles on her nose. I think of her shyness in crowds and the slightly off-key way she sang. I think of her stubbornness during arguments and the fierceness of her loyalty. This is my inheritance, more real than any sum of money or genetic predisposition. Sometimes I think the human heart is like a Roman bridge. All these broken bits of rock that somehow supports itself miraculously after all this time. Time will break our hearts. Sickness will break our hearts. Regret will break our hearts. But we all find ways to mend, to find ways of making the pieces fit. And this is mine. Like I said, I've been thinking a lot about inheritance lately.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we see how a new robot is playing an important role in hip and knee surgeries, and how a local support group is making a difference in the lives of prostate cancer patients. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.